this morning we're going to pick up where we left off last week. If you remember, right at the end of the service, I drew a diagram up here that talked about us moving forward and God moving forward. And sometimes those paths don't seem like it's straight, but it might be that they're actually straighter than we think because God is pulling us back onto His path. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go back into Acts and we're going to move forward a little bit there. And what I want to talk about this morning is what do we do in those times when God seems distant or God just doesn't seem like He's there? I thought what Don shared this morning was so appropriate. Well, what do we do when we hit those walls, those spiritual walls with God? Well, not by my plans, but sort of by divine intervention, I guess you could say that we're going to jump back into Acts because I was going to move on. I was going to move to some other material, which I started moving, and we did move that way, but then it ended up just lining up with where we left off in Acts. So where we're going to go this morning is Acts chapter 7, and we're going to continue in Stephen's speech, and we're going to look down. We're going to pick up with about at verse 9 and move on a little bit. Today we're going to learn that even though God's map app may take us on some very difficult roads, God is still with us. God never abandons us. So last week we started with Stephen telling or giving the speech before the Sanhedrin or before the Pharisees, and he started with talking about Abraham and all the bad things that Abraham's family would have to go through, all the difficulties he would face, and yet God was leading him. And so Abraham followed God. He stayed with God. Well, this week, Stephen now goes on to a second man from Israel's antiquity, from their history, named Joseph. So we're going to take a look at the life of Joseph. So Acts chapter 7, and we're going to pick up with verse 9. Because the patriarchs were jealous of Joseph, they sold him as a slave into Egypt. But God was with him and rescued him from all of his troubles. He gave Joseph wisdom and enabled him to gain the goodwill of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So Pharaoh made him ruler over all of Egypt and all his palace. Then a famine struck all of Egypt and Canaan, bringing great suffering, and our ancestors could not find food. When Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent our forefathers on their first visit. On their second visit, Joseph told his brothers who he was, and Pharaoh learned about Joseph's family. After this, Joseph sent his father, or father Jacob, sent for his father Jacob and his whole family, 75 in all. Then Jacob went down to Egypt, where he and our ancestors died. Their bodies were brought back to Shechem and placed in the tomb that Abraham had bought from the sons of Hamor at Shechem for a certain sum of money. One of the phrases that Stephen says or makes in here I really like is that, but God was with him. God was with him. What do we do in those moments when we feel like God may not be with us? How are we reminded, or how can we keep in our thoughts and our minds that God does stay with us, even in those troubled times? I want to push in on that thought this morning. I think it's pertinent because I think Stephen was going through some of this. Stephen was citing this and giving this story, not just for himself, but for the church and for the Pharisees as well. God has not abandoned us. For the Pharisees at that time, there was 600 years of silence. The Old Testament is done. It's like God disappeared. Rome came in and conquered them, and now God was just gone. God was silent. And Stephen is telling these guys who knew this story full well, he's telling these guys, but God was with Joseph, and God is still with us. And he's going to unveil that God is with us through Jesus Christ. Well, I want to go back and just recap the story of Joseph really quick if you're not familiar with it. I would encourage you, go back and read it. It starts in Genesis chapter 37, and it moves through the end of Genesis in chapter 50. But just to recap of the story a little bit, Joseph was born to Jacob. Jacob had four wives. That in itself, all of us guys should understand, would cause you problems. Not only that, but Rachel, sister was Leah, and they were both his wives, and they didn't like each other because Jacob never wanted to marry Joseph, Jacob never wanted to marry Leah, but was forced to marry Leah in order to marry Rachel. So these two sisters aren't getting along at all. And then they begin to have baby fights. They begin to have babies in order to gain Jacob's affection. And so they give them their maidservant. So now Jacob has four, basically, wives that he's producing kids by. And the only one that can't produce kids is the lady that Jacob loves the most, Rachel. Finally, in Rachel's old age and Jacob's old age, Rachel gets pregnant and gives birth to a son. His name's called Joseph. Needless to say, the other brothers didn't like him. He has 10 older brothers. There is a lot of bad family dynamics. So if you think you have a messed up family, go back and look at the family life of Jacob. It was, really messed up. And so all of Joseph's brothers did not like him or his little brother Benjamin, the youngest of the bunch. In fact, they hated him so much that they wanted to kill him. Now, how many of you have enough family problems that one of the kids in your house wants to kill one of the other kids in your house? I mean, seriously, they're figuring out, how can we kill them? Well, that's what's going on in this family. Well, Joseph is daddy's favorite boy. So all the older boys are off tending Jacob's herds in a far-off land, and Jacob sends Joseph to go spy on them. Now, do you think that's a great idea? Probably not a good idea if it's already family tension here. Not only that, but Joseph, who was blessed with interesting dreams, told his brothers and his dad, "Someday you will bow down and serve me." Ooh, that went over really well too. So these guys, they really had it out for this kid. And so here comes Joseph now, spying on his brothers in a far-off land. They see the opportunity that we can kill him. And so they grab him, and they're going to kill him. But big brother Reuben jumps in, saves the day, and says, "It wouldn't be smart for us to kill Jacob or Joseph." And so what they end up doing is throwing him into a pit. Reuben goes off to do some business or something. He gets away from the rest of the group, and the group decides, let's pull that traitor, that bratty little kid out of the pit, and hey, look at those merchants over there, those Ishmaelite merchants, let's sell them to them. And so they sell Joseph to these merchants. Reuben comes back. He freaks out. "Did you kill him?" "No, we just sold him, so we don't have to deal with that kid anymore." They take his robe. They dip it in blood. They take it back to their dad and said, "Look what we found. Isn't this your favorite son's robe? An animal must have killed him." So now Jacob thinks his favorite son's dead. The other brothers think he's who knows where, maybe dead by now, who knows what, but we got rid of the kid. And Joseph now is taken down to Egypt by these Ishmael servants. Or merchants. The merchants then sell Joseph to a man named Potiphar. And this picks up in chapter 39 of Genesis. So Joseph, or Potiphar, is one of Pharaoh's right-hand man. So he is an advisor to Pharaoh. He's high up in the nation of Egypt. Joseph goes into Potiphar's home. He does really well in Potiphar's home. In fact, he has risen up in power, which is very unusual. He's a bright young man. He's a handsome young man. But he is a slave, and he is a Hebrew. And yet Potiphar so respects Joseph's abilities, he puts him in charge of his entire house. Finally, Joseph's life is turning around. Things are going his way. He is in charge of his entire master's household. But then Potiphar's wife comes along. And Potiphar's wife thinks Joseph is a good-looking guy. And so she wants to sleep with Joseph and keeps trying to get Joseph in bed with her. Well, Joseph is a man of integrity, and so he keeps refusing. And then finally, on one particular day, she just really wants him. And so she invites him into the house. He's doing work in the house, and she tries to get him back in bed. He refuses, and he escapes, but she grabs his coat. And then when husband gets home, because she's so mad about this whole situation, she tells her husband, "Look at this servant you brought in here. I got his coat. He came in my bedroom, and he tried to have sport with me. He tried to rape me." And so Potiphar gets mad. He grabs Joseph and throws him into jail. This poor kid's done nothing wrong. Maybe he has a little bit of a bratty attitude, but he hasn't done anything wrong. And now he ends up in jail, where he sits for the next several years. Well, eventually, Joseph continues to be a good guy. The jailers see how good of a guy Joseph is, that he has skill in management and leadership, and eventually the jailers put Joseph in charge of the entire prison, of all the other prisoners. And so life is once again, he's in jail, but life isn't too bad. You know, as head dude, you got some perks and whatnot, you know, and you get the good food rather than the nasty food, and you get to call some of the shots and whatnot. So life is going okay for Joseph, even though he's still in prison. And then all of a sudden, Pharaoh gets mad at the baker and the cupbearer, throws them into jail. And while these guys are in here, Joseph sees them and sees that they're distraught. Something's really bothering these two guys. And so he asks them, what's wrong? And the guy said, well, we keep having troubling dreams. And Joseph's like, really? Tell me the dreams. And so the cupbearer says, well, I keep having this dream that I have three vines that are ripe and they come to full fruit. I squeeze the grapes of one of the vines into a cup and I take the cup and I give it to my master. And Joseph's like, well, that's interesting. Here's what that dream means. That the three vines are 3 days. In 3 days, you're going to once again be squeezing the grapes and putting the cup back into Pharaoh's hand. You're going to be risen back to power. And the cupbearer's like, oh, that's so cool. Thank you, Joseph, for interpreting the dream. It so makes sense. Is there anything I can do for you? And Joseph said, just one thing. When you go to be back in Pharaoh's court, don't forget me. I'm stuck in this nasty prison, and I'd sure like to get out. I didn't do anything wrong. Just don't forget me. Okay, I won't forget you. Well, the baker saw that that was such a good dream interpretation. He's like, okay, well, why don't you interpret my dream? And Joseph's like, okay. And the baker says, okay, I have three baskets on my head, and there's baked goods in the top basket, but birds keep coming and eating all of the bread that's in the top basket. And Joseph prays to God, and he says, okay, here's what that dream means. For you, the baskets are 3 days, and you're a baker, so that's why there's baked goods up there, and the birds represent death. And for you, in 3 days, the king will lift off your head and impale your body on a pole. Yay. Well, guess what? 3 days pass, and guess what happens? The baker gets his head lifted off, gets his body impaled on a pole, and the cupbearer gets risen back to power and comes back to serve the king. Remember, a cupbearer is one of the most trusted servants that a king has. He's going to sample everything the king's going to eat so nobody could poison the king. The king highly trusts the cupbearer. And the cupbearer gets back to his position where he has the ear of the king. And so now the cupbearer can tell the king and get the pardon for Joseph. And Joseph's life can finally get back on track. And guess what happens? Cupbearer totally forgets. Totally blows off poor Joseph. And so here is Joseph again for several years sitting in a prison. Well, eventually, about 2 years or so down the road, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, begins to have troubling dreams. And his dreams are so bad, it says that all of Egypt was troubled with them, and nobody could tell him what the dreams meant. And this is going on apparently for some time, maybe a month or 2 months or so. And finally, after all this time, dreams, interpreting, ring a bell, cupbearer, hello? The cupbearer's like, oh, hey, wait, hang on. I know a guy who can interpret dreams. And he tells Pharaoh what Joseph did for him. Well, the king, Pharaoh, tells the guys, go get Joseph out of prison and bring him to me. And so Joseph comes to the king. The king talks to him about his dreams. And then Joseph goes to prayer, comes back to the king, and says, here's what the dreams mean. And I'm just going to give you the result. He says that the dreams represent 7 great years for Egypt. You're going to have bumper crops. Or the bounty of all the land is going to be yours. It's going to be a wonderful 7 years. You're going to think, man, this is the best harvest we've ever had. But it's going to be followed by 7 severely famined years. And thousands of people are going to die. Whoa, that matches. Everything works. And Joseph said it would be wise of the king to appoint somebody to make sure you collect enough crops so you have plenty to eat during the bad times. Well, Pharaoh looks around, and he looks around his court and looks at everybody around. And he's like, you know what? I don't know anybody else in this room that could accomplish this task like that young man. What if we put him in charge of this, and we'll see if it all works out. And so Joseph now gets put in charge of all of this harvest, of saving the right crops so that when the famine comes, they will have plenty of food. And guess what happens over the next 7 to 8 years? Best crops Egypt has ever seen. And on year 7, guess what happens? Famine begins to strike the land. When all this comes to pass, what ends up happening is that God raises Joseph up to the second in command in Egypt. There is nobody more powerful in Egypt than Pharaoh himself. He's over everybody and everything. Well, the famine is so severe that it strikes the entire region. Remember, Israel, by the way, if you look at a map, Israel's just up here on the other side of the Mediterranean Sea. And so the region, that whole region, goes through this famine, and Jacob and his family living back in Egypt also suffer the famine. And so what happens is Jacob hears that there's food down in Egypt, so he sends his kids down to Egypt to go get some food so that they might survive. Well, guess who's in charge of Egypt? Joseph, their brother, that they sold to slavery and wanted to kill. Well, after a couple visits, finally, Joseph realizes who his brothers are. He realizes who they are right off the bat. The brothers finally reveal or find out who Joseph is because he reveals himself to them. And Joseph now has opportunity to seek his revenge. For all that hatred, for all that vengeance, for them trying to kill him and wanting him dead, for all of their jealousy, finally Joseph has the opportunity to give them what they deserve. And then Genesis 50:20 has one of the Old Testament's most remarkable comments. Here was Joseph's response to his brothers when he could finally seek the revenge. "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." Rather than seek vengeance, rather than getting mad, Joseph saw a bigger picture. He saw God at work. So why does Stephen, in his speech to the Pharisees, reference Joseph? Why does he tell them this story? I mean, these guys, they know full well the story of Joseph. They're the smart guys. They're the leaders, the teachers, the professors of the land. So why is Stephen telling him this story? Well, Stephen is telling them the story of Joseph because in that time frame of Israel's history, God seems very distant. 600 years, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the religious leaders have been looking for God, and God has been silent. That's a long time for God to be silent. For 600 years, bad things have been happening to the nation of Israel. They have been conquered by the Romans. They are no longer a people unto themselves. They're basically enslaved to the Romans. The Romans don't like them. They think they're nasty, dirty people. And so they're now being ruled by the Romans, and God is silent. They're looking for something. They're looking for a Messiah, but God's nowhere to be found. Why does Stephen tell him this story? Because Stephen was setting up that God is not distant. God is close. He's so close that he sent Messiah. He sent his son. He sent Jesus. I want to take a look at some lessons that we can learn from the story that Stephen tells of Joseph and also from the life of Joseph himself. So let me just go through five quick lessons here. Lesson number one, there will come times in our lives when God will seem to have forsaken us. There will come times in our lives, as Don said earlier, where we hit the wall, where God just seems quiet, far off, distant. I cannot imagine how Joseph felt when his brothers betrayed him and plotted to kill him, when he was sold as common cattle to foreigners, when he was sold as a slave in Egypt. Where was God when Joseph finally had found his path in Potiphar's house, but then that was taken away because of a deceitful mistress who wanted to pursue him for sexual gain? Where was God when he got thrown into jail unjustly, when he was forgotten after blessing one of the king's closest companions, the cupbearer? What a powerful reminder that even for the most saintly, they go through times when God seems to have forsaken them. The Pharisees knew this story. Joseph's comment is talking right to their hearts. God seems to have disappeared. God seems to be gone. But God is not gone. God is still closer. I love that comment. But God was still with him. It's only when you know the total story that you begin to understand that in all of these calamities, God was with Joseph. God was with the nation of Israel. And here's the encouragement for us. Even through our calamities, God is still with us. God knows the future. He can see what is coming. He knows exactly how things are going to play out. And he is able to put all the pieces together so that his will can be done. God knew a drought was coming. He knew that it would take the resources of Egypt to be able to help Jacob's family survive, and consequently to fulfill his promise that he gave to Abraham, that through Abraham and his children, if they die off of a famine, that wouldn't happen. God knew that this was all going to take place, and it was going to be Egypt that was going to save Abraham's family so that Messiah may come, so that salvation can come to the world. God knew Joseph needed to go before Pharaoh to accomplish what God needed done, not just in a lifespan, but in many lifespans. As you look at the story from this perspective, you begin to see that behind every calamity, there is purpose. In the midst of troubling times, everything may seem confusing. God may seem to abandon you. Nothing may seem to make sense. We hear the story of Joseph and are reminded that even in all these times, God is still with us. St. Paul found himself in some of those very situations. And in Romans 8:28, he wrote, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose." Lesson number two. In our suffering, we, like Joseph, are foreshadows of Jesus Christ. David Guzik commented that one reason Stephen referenced Joseph is that Joseph was a foreshadow of Jesus. As I began to ponder that, I realized how powerful a thought that was. This was also one of the reasons why Stephen's speech actually resulted in his death. Because Stephen was declaring, Joseph is just like Jesus. How could you miss Jesus? You saw Joseph. You know Joseph. Joseph was a forerunner of Christ. Joseph suffered for no apparent reason. God graciously, through his dreams, revealed the purpose of his life, and that may have helped him get through things. But nonetheless, Joseph, to no fault of his own, suffered. But it was through that very suffering that many lives were spared, and the work of God through the nation of Israel continued. Had Joseph not been hated by his brothers, he would not have been sold. If not sold, not enslaved. If not enslaved, not thrown in jail where he met the wine bearer. Had he not been forgotten, he would not have been available when the king had his dreams. And had he not been there to interpret those dreams of the king, many, many people would have starved to death, including the nation of Israel, his own family. God's promise, therefore, of salvation would not have come to the world. The promise that he gave Abraham. So it was the very suffering that Joseph faced that brought salvation to Israel and eventually brought salvation to us and brought salvation to the world. Joseph was a foreshadow of Jesus Christ. Several thousand years later, a couple will become divinely pregnant and give birth to a son. From the very beginning, his life and his family's life will suffer because of it. They'll be forced from their homeland and made to live in Egypt. When it finally becomes safe to move home, they will not be able to move to their own hometown because it's still not safe for the child who they've named Jesus. Apparently, somewhere in Jesus' adolescence, his father dies, leaving him fatherless and responsible to run the family business, take care of his mom, his brothers, and his sisters. Eventually, he's able to leave those responsibilities and move on to his true calling in life, his ministry, and his teaching about God. Eventually, through those 3 years of teaching, he comes to be hated. He becomes loved by a few, but becomes hated by many. And eventually, even the ones who love him betray him. And eventually this Jesus gets put to death of no fault of his own on a cross. But it is through that cross that salvation comes to the world. Joseph and Jesus, very similar tracks. Just like Joseph, Jesus suffered not because of his choices he made, not because of his bad actions or wrong decisions. He suffered because of God's will to bring salvation to the world. 1 Peter 2, verse 21, Peter understood this. Peter becomes the leader of the church, the first pope of the church. And Peter writes this to the church, "To this you were called, because Christ suffered you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin. No deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on a cross, so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds, you have been healed. Jesus suffered for us so that we could be healed. I believe this is what Stephen was pointing to. He was pointing to the reality that Jesus was just like Joseph. They all knew Joseph suffered pointlessly, that Joseph, you know, it was of no fault to his own. They understood that story. They got that. And Stephen then turns it around and says, Jesus was just like Joseph. Why can't you get that? Why can't you understand that? God is with us. God has not abandoned us. God was with Joseph. God was with Jesus. God is with us. Lesson number three, be careful about misconceptions of following God's plan. Be careful about misconceptions of following God's plan. I have a fear for the church today. It's no secret that commercialism's invaded the church. That's quite evident in the whole epidemic of church hopping, going from one church to the next because this church does a little better than that church over this, and so we just leave this one and go to that one. It screams of commercialism in the church. And one of my biggest fears for the church of today is that we have a misconception of following God that I think that as a church we've unknowingly maybe promoted. We have this idea that if we follow God, all things will just work out well and everything will be dandy in life. That everything will be rosy. That life will go better, that life will be easy, that everything will make sense, and everything will just be nice. Well, this past year, I went through the Bible in a year. So I began reading it, Michelle and I did, and reading it and listening to it. And one of the things that became very evident as I was going quickly through the scriptures, all the Bible, is that over and over again, one of the huge truths that kept coming up is that following God is no guarantee of the easy or nice life. Following God is no guarantee of the easy or nice life. If anything, the scriptures paint a complete opposite picture. It paints a picture of difficulty, of sorrow, of confusion, of pain, not understanding what God is doing, even of suffering for those who are willing to follow Christ. Now, to be fair, I want to be fair, it also tells us that we will have purpose, that we will have understanding, that we will have insight, that we will have power over evil and sin, that we will be filled with love, that we will be happy, that we will have joy in our lives. All of those things come as well. So, yeah, there may be some bad stuff, but there's also some good things as well. It also promises that we will have the best life possible, but keep in mind, the best life possible isn't by world standards. It's by God's standards. And Joseph had the best life possible, even though as you look at it, it's like, oh, I don't know that that's that great. Well, it was by God's standards. It was an awesome life. It by no means that we, following Christ, by no means means that we will have the happy, pain-free life, but we will have the best life. Yet it was through the very sorrow, it was through the hardships that God was bringing about his glory and his good through the life of Joseph. St. Peter again tells the church, be alert and of sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith, because you know that the family of believers throughout the world undergo the same kind of suffering. And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong, firm, and steadfast. Be careful about misconception of following God's plan. It is the best life, but it doesn't mean it's going to be rosy. Lesson number four, don't take the shortcuts. Don't take the shortcuts. As I was putting all the pieces together and looking at all of this, what popped into my mind is that we are a people who love shortcuts. How many of you love shortcuts? How many of you have a microwave in your house? You love shortcuts, you know. We don't want to wait for the oven to warm up. We don't want to wait for the kettle to go to boil to make a pot of coffee on the stove. No, we buy Keurig, so we push a button and pfft, we got coffee. You know, we have microwaves so we can instantly heat our food up and warm our food up. Then we download and have Google Maps on our phones so that when we're driving somewhere, there's a roadblock, it'll tell you so you can get around it. It'll tell you if all the traffic on 71 is really slow. We love our shortcuts. We fill our homes with our shortcuts. We have remote controls with 50 buttons on them, so we never have to get up and touch a TV or any media appliance that's in the media center. We like our shortcuts. We don't even have speed dial anymore. We have Alexa now who can just find the phone number and dial it for you. Isn't that fun? We love our shortcuts. We don't want to wait for the nice house, the dream house. We'll buy it now. We don't want to wait for the shiny, nice widget. We want to just put it on the credit card now, have it now, and then we'll worry about paying for it later. We love our shortcuts. Our lives are full of shortcuts. And so it's no stretch of the imagination that when it comes to our future and our faith, we want the shortcuts as well. We like the shortcuts. We want to bypass the pain. We want to skip right over all the hurts and the struggles that God will use to shape us and mold us and prepare us. We want to move right into the mansion without ever having to buy the starter home. We want to avoid all the tough paths that God's map app may actually take us through. I've told the story before, I don't know if in a sermon necessarily, but to a few people. A few years ago, we got to take the trip of a lifetime. We went out to Colorado. And it was an awesome trip. It was going through Colorado, by the way, is very, very ugly. If you ever go out there, there's only this part that's pretty. The rest of it's ugly, and it is flat. You think Iowa's bad? Colorado's worse. So we finally get out to the mountains. We go up into Denver. We go up to Pikes Peak. We do the Valley of the Gods. Then we went down to Durango, and Durango's sort of more of a dead area, but that's the Jeep capital of the world. So one of the things that I want to do in Durango was rent a Jeep and go on the back mining trails and up into the mountains and whatnot. So we rent this oversized, huge Jeep that was really too big, but it looked cool, so we rented the sucker, and we go out on the trails. The kids thought this was awesome. I was white-knuckling it, and Michelle was freaking out the whole way. Right? You guys were there. They're like, this is cool. And Mom's like, we're going to die, we're going to die. Every road we go on, you know, this is a rock wall, and that is death, you know. And we're driving. Finally, we come up to California Pass. So we're going through a couple mining towns, and that was really cool to see these old ghost towns. We come up into California Pass, and as I pull up onto the pass, you come up the mountain this way, and you're going to go back down off this way. And as I pulled up, everybody who was up there had pulled their cars right along the edge. I mean, we're talking death, you know, and that's where they parked their cars. And this thing is only about maybe 4 or 5 car stalls wide. It's probably narrower than from me to that wall. And I'm like, no way. I pull my car right up into the middle because I was going to be safe. As soon as I park the car, the kids get out. They're all like, this is cool. We can see forever. And they're going, Caleb's like, oh, wow, this is neat. You know, I'm running after the kids. Michelle falls out of the Jeep and literally falls to the ground and is crying. There's an older couple, bless their sweet little hearts. There's an older couple in a brown Jeep. I still remember it. You remember the Jeeps out of MASH? That was the kind of Jeep they had, those kind of tires too. And they come over to Michelle and start consoling her. I'm over trying to catch the kids and make sure they're not going to do a nosedive or whatnot. And finally, we wrangle up the kids. We've had our moment, and we're going to move back into the Jeep. We're going to go back to the Jeep and figure out what to do next. And this couple said one of life's most profound statements. It was to Michelle. It was an amazing statement. They come over to Michelle, who is not happy, let's just put it that way, of being up there. And they said, honey, you have to get back in the Jeep to go down. This was actually a very profound statement. You see, we love the mountaintops. Who doesn't? You're above the clouds. The air is quite thin. What was it, 12,500 feet or... 14,693, depending on which part of that little plateau we were on. Right? Michelle knows. 14,000, it's beautiful up there. You're above the clouds, you're looking down, you're seeing these little tiny Jeeps coming up. You know, that trip, we're like, whoa, we came up that, we're idiots, you know. It's awesome to be up there. But guess what? At night, at 14,000 feet, it's cold. Even in the hottest summer days, it's cold. In fact, it's so high and so cold that the trees decided not to go up there either. And so it's all rock. There's no grass up there. There's no animals up there. So while it's cool to be up there and it's neat to look over all of this, you can't live up there. It's impossible. And guess what? If you can't live up there, what do you have to do? Get back in the Jeep. Do the very thing you don't want to do. Go back down. It was a profound statement. And this is an incredible lesson for us to comprehend as well. Don't take the shortcuts. You see, here's the deal. I think sometimes in our faith, we want the end result of Joseph's life. We want that moment when he was king of all of Egypt under Pharaoh. We want that moment when he could have sought revenge and taken it out on his brothers. We all want that moment where we can go, told you so. We want those moments. We want to live there. But Joseph would have never been there had he not done this up the mountain and done this back down several times. I don't think Joseph would have been second in charge of Egypt had Potiphar's wife not accused him, if his brothers had not sold him into slavery. He wouldn't have been the man necessary and needed to save all of Egypt and his family had he not gone through the pain of the travel up and the travel down. Don't be tempted to take the shortcuts. And when we run into life's problems, we run into the struggles that we just don't understand. Why is this happening to me? Or how can I walk through this? Or how can I face this? When we hit those moments, don't look for shortcuts. God, just take me through it. What do we need to do to get through this one? Lesson number 5. In the midst of all of that, never forget God was with him and God will be with you. It may seem like this God is way off, that God isn't there, but God is there. And I want to end with this thought this morning. Yesterday we went up to Chris Graff's funeral. And one of the things, we're not Lutheran. I don't know if y'all realize that. But we don't wear the robes. I don't do the robe thing, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But as I was looking at Pastor Jim Watson yesterday, he had his vestments on. Sometimes I think it would be cool for the pastor to wear vestments, because sometimes I need to hide myself under God. There's this morning, as we walk through this last area, I don't speak to you as John. I need to speak to you as pastor, because I need to hear this as John. Does that make sense? I need to hear this as well. Never forget God is with you. Despite all that Joseph was going through, God was with him. In the midst of the valleys and the goings ups and the going downs from the mountaintop, God was there. God was walking with Joseph. And that's the huge point that Stephen was calling out and making to these hardened Jewish leaders, the Pharisees. Let's look back at the story. God delivered Joseph from death. The brothers wanted to kill him. God sent Reuben at just the right time to say, no, it's not Joseph's time yet. God saved him from horrible slavery and allowed him to find refuge in Potiphar's house. He could have been sold as a slave to a horrible situation, but God somehow got him into Potiphar's house. God put him in the right jail so that he could be with the right jailers who actually recognize that this Hebrew has some talents that can benefit the jail and the prison. God delivered him from his master's wife's enticements. Now, it's sort of interesting. He ends up in jail over these enticements that his wife, that Potiphar's wife was trying to throw at him. But he ends up in jail because he never sacrifices integrity. He never gave in. He never said, hey, you know, she wants me, why not get a little fun on the side? He never went there. He's thrown in jail for his integrity. And this is sort of interesting. In Genesis chapter 39, verse 1, I went back and read all of the section of Genesis. Genesis 39, 1 tells us that Potiphar was one of Pharaoh's officials. Do you think that's an accident? Do you know how many slave owners there were? And Potiphar was one of Pharaoh's assistants. And guess who was standing there the day that the cupbearer said, hey, there's this guy in jail that can tell dreams, and they bring this kid, this Hebrew guy, in before Pharaoh. Guess who's standing right next to Pharaoh? Wait, I know this guy. And I bet you Potiphar knew full well his wife had ill intentions, that it wasn't true. I got a feeling Potiphar understood that. And now here is Potiphar whispering in Pharaoh's ear, this guy has integrity. This guy had opportunity with my wife and refused and even went to jail over it. This is a guy you can trust, Pharaoh. God used that. God remembered Joseph even though the cupbearer forgot him. In all of these things, Stephen's telling the persecutors, his persecutors, and it's fascinating,
You know why Stephen's here? He's an average layperson. He's not a pastor. He's not trained as a clergy or anything like that. He's not one of the disciples. He's an average layperson in the church who got risen up to take over some responsibilities of leadership in the church. And then the Pharisees saw some of what he was doing in ministry. They didn't like it. They began to question him. The Holy Spirit comes on Stephen, and Stephen's wisdom because the Holy Spirit was so strong that the Pharisees could not refute him. And now they trumped up charges, threw him into jail, and are now debating with him, and they're basically putting him on trial, and they're causing, they said that he's blasphemed, which is punishable by death. So this is actually Stephen's trial for his own life. And he's still telling the story of God. Still telling the story to the Pharisees who aren't getting it. You're looking for Jesus, and God sent him. Why don't you get this? Just going to jump forward just a moment so you know the end. Stephen ends up being stoned after this testimony. I think Stephen wasn't just preaching the Pharisees. I think Stephen was reminding him, reminding the church, reminding us that even when things don't seem like they're going our way, God is still with us. He's still working out his plans in our lives. Don't forget, no matter what you go through, God is with us. No matter what you're going through right now, God's preparing you for something greater. I heard that 1,000 times before when we were doing Celebrate Recovery, and sometimes the cynic in me questions that a little bit. Does God really work all things out for our good? And sometimes I don't know, you know, because the reality is we all die. You all know that, right? Just don't want to blow anybody's minds, okay? So it's going to happen. So how is God working all things out? And I was reading through a commentator this week, Chuck Smith, and he shared about Stephen's speech, and what he shared sort of caught me off guard and sort of hit me right upside the head. I'm like, whoa, that is just profound. Because sometimes we look into our lives and we're like, I do not know how God is going to work this out. I don't know how this is going to turn out for my good, his glory. I just don't get it. And then Chuck Smith went to some verses, and I thought, this is fascinating. Because God doesn't always work things out right now, but he is working, he's more concerned about eternity than he is a blip in time called 60 years of life. Listen to these verses. I'm going to go out to Revelation. Revelation chapter 5, verse 9 and 10. This is what God's doing in us right now. And they sang a new song saying, you are worthy to take the scroll, talking about Jesus, and to open its seals because you were slain. And with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation. Who's being talked about there? Us. That Jesus died so that he had the right to redeem us, to bring us into the family of God. You have made them, talking about us, to be a kingdom and, catch this, priests to serve our God, and they will reign on earth. Did you catch that? John sees into the future, and he says, you know, Jesus is bringing all these people together, and all those that are redeemed under his salvation, under his penalty, his sacrifice that he took, all those people that come to be a part of his kingdom, God is now preparing to be priests and preparing to be kings, to reign with God in eternity. God ain't preparing you just for this life. He's preparing you to reign and to be a priest for eternity. If that's not enough, let's go a little further for Revelation chapter 20, verse 6. Blessed and holy are those who share in the first resurrection. In other words, salvation while we're still breathing on this earth. The second death has no power over them. That would be being judged and thrown into hell. The second death has no power over them, but they will be priests of God and Christ and will reign with him for 1,000 years. God's preparing us for something that goes beyond this life. Even Paul understood this. So he wrote to the Corinthian church, 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 13 and 18. It was written, I believed, therefore I have spoken. Since we have that same spirit of faith, we also believe and therefore speak, because we know that the one who raised the Lord Jesus from the dead will also raise us with Jesus and present us with you to himself. All this is for your benefit, so that the grace that is reaching more and more people may cause thanksgiving to overflow to the glory of God. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen. Since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. This is momentary problems. God is preparing and working in us for eternity, for glorious ministry we will have forever here on this earth and even the days that will come once this earth is over. He's preparing us to be priests for Him and to be reigning with Him for eternity. And I hope that you can have that thought in your mind this morning. I don't know what your week will be like. Shucks, on Sunday, I don't know what my week will be like. I don't know what lies ahead in the next 7 days. But as you go through your week, whatever it is that you face, remember, even in the valleys, even in the tough times, God is with you. He's preparing you for something greater. And if not in this life, definitely for the next life. And Stephen reminds us that through the life of Joseph, God is preparing all of us to be kings. And then Stephen dies. You see, God wasn't preparing Stephen maybe for that moment. He used him. But God was preparing Stephen for something even greater that death couldn't even take away. The end of the story for Stephen is that he was stoned to death and dies at the hand of the Apostle Paul, who later becomes the leader of the church. God was working all things out. Didn't seem like it maybe at the moment. And right now you may face troubles. Right now you may be going through something difficult or hard in your life. But I want you to remember, God was with Joseph and God is with you. Emmanuel. God is with us. Dear Heavenly Father, during this month, as we're looking into the future, as we're talking about where the church is going, where our futures will take us, as we're talking about your map app, the directions that you take us in life, as we look to the future from our vantage point now, some things may not look too rosy and too great. We may question whether there really is a rainbow behind every storm or a silver lining with every cloud. But Father, as we look to the future, it doesn't end here. It doesn't end in 20, 30, 40, 80 years. Our futures go beyond the grave. And you are doing something grand in us. The struggles, the trials, the problems we're going through, you're with us. And you're working your glory out. Maybe we'll have the honor and the privilege of seeing it. Maybe we won't. But Father, someday we will reign with you. Someday we will be priests of heaven. We'll be worshiping you and adoring you. We'll be in the praise band, even though we may not have been able to sing worth a lick on earth. We'll be able to keep a beat. We'll be able to maybe be a cook in making the best food ever had. Someday we will get to fully serve you and reign with you. And Father, I don't know what you'll do to prepare us for that. I don't know what you'll take us through. But I pray you'll give us the grace as we walk through it to remember you're present. You're with us. You're still God. You're still in charge. You're still in control. You're still working all things out for your glory and your good. Father, go with us this week. Help us to be encouraged, even if we face a trial or a struggle. Help us to still find joy in our hearts because we know you're in this and you're helping us. So in a very real way, God, go with us as we leave this place. And may we be ministers for you wherever we go. May we take the joy that we have in you through the trials that we have. May we take it to the people that we meet. And Father, may we have opportunity to share your love to the world just as your Son did. In your name, I ask these things and these blessings upon your people. Amen.